January 1993, Pakistani vessel shipping arms to Bosnia is intercepted. 10 containers of arms destined for the Bosnian army is intercepted in the Adriatic Sea. Pakistan also airlifts sophisticated anti-tank guided missiles to the Bosnian Muslims. January 20, 1993, Bill Clinton is inaugurated as president. January 25, 1993. I don't remember this happening. Vaguely I do, but I don't really remember it. On January 25, 1993, a Pakistani militant named Mir Amal Qazi walks up to the main headquarters of CIA headquarters in Langley and opens fire with an AK-47. He shoots 5 CIA personnel as they sit in their cars. 2 of them are killed. Then he walks off and flies back to Pakistan. He gets away. A massive international manhunt ensues, and a joint FBI-CIA team eventually capture him in a central Pakistani town in 1997. He is then rendered to the U.S. instead of going through the less controversial but lengthier extradition process. While Qazi apparently acted alone, he will be treated as a hero and sheltered by radical Islamists in Afghanistan until his capture. Qazi will be convicted of murder later in 97. 4 U.S. oil workers will be killed in Pakistan one day later in apparent retaliation. Qazi will later say that he was upset with U.S. policy in the Middle East and was hoping to assassinate the CIA director. He is executed in 2002. February 1993 to May 94, U.S. military head and GAO recommend reducing units dedicated to continental air defense. The Continental Air Defense System, carried out by the North American Aerospace Defense Command, NORAD, was developed during the Cold War to protect against any Soviet bombers that might try to attack the U.S. via the North Pole. In 1960, NORAD had about 1,200 fighters dedicated to the task, but now its U.S. portion comprises 180 Air National Guard fighters located in 10 units and 14 alert sites around the U.S. In February 93, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff Colin Powell issues a report in which he suggests that, due to former Soviet Union no longer posing a significant threat, the mission could be transferred to existing general-purpose combat and training forces. In May 94, the GAO issues a report agreeing with Powell, saying that a dedicated Continental Air Defense Force is no longer needed. The report also says NORAD plans to reduce the number of alert sites in the continental United States to 14 and provide 28 aircraft for the day-to-day peacetime air sovereignty mission. Each alert site will have 2 fighters, and their crews will be on 24-hour duty and ready to scramble within 5 minutes. NORAD will play a key role in responding to the hijackings on 9/11. By then, it will just have 14 fighters available. The GAO report points out that launching fighters in response to suspicious aircraft is a routine occurrence, saying overall, during the past 4 years, NORAD's alert fighters took off to intercept aircraft, referred to as scrambled, 1,518 times, or an average of 15 times per site per year. Of these incidents, the number of suspected drug smuggling aircraft averaged 1 per site, or less than 7% of all the alert site's total activity. The remaining activity generally involved visually inspecting unidentified aircraft and assisting aircraft in distress. February 11, 1993, hijacking raises concern of plane being crashed into a New York building. A 20-year-old Ethiopian man hijacks a Lufthansa Airbus bound from Frankfurt to Addis Ababa via Cairo. Wielding a gun, which is subsequently found to be just a starter pistol, he forces the pilot to divert the plane to New York. The 11-hour ordeal ends after the plane lands at JFK and the hijacker surrenders to the FBI. Journalist Eric Margolis, who happens to be on the plane, says he and the other passengers are convinced the hijacker intended to crash the plane into Manhattan. While giving television commentary on the morning of 9/11, Larry Johnson, currently the deputy director of the State Department's Office of Counterterrorism, will say it was feared when the plane was flown to New York that it might be crashing into something. This is the last hijacking to occur prior to 9/11. February 26, 1993, the World Trade Center is bombed, but does not collapse as the bombers had hoped. Bomb damage in underground levels of the World Trade Center. An attempt to topple the World Trade Center fails, but 6 people are killed and over 1,000 injured in the misfired blast. An FBI explosives expert later states that if they had found the exact architectural Achilles heel, or if the bomb had been a little bit bigger, not much more, 500 pounds more, I think it would have brought her down. Ramzi Youssef, who has close ties to bin Laden, organizes the attempt. The New York Times later reports on Imad Salem, an undercover agent who will be the key government witness in the trial against Youssef. Salem testifies that the FBI knew about the attack beforehand and told him they would thwart it by substituting a harmless powder for the explosives. However, an FBI supervisor called off this plan and the bombing was not stopped. Other suspects were ineptly investigated before the bombing as early as 1990. Several of the bombers were trained by the CIA to fight in the Afghan War, and the CIA later concludes in internal documents that it was partly culpable for this bombing. 9/11 mastermind Khalid Sheikh Mohammed is an uncle of Youssef and also has a role in the World Trade Center bombing. One of the attackers even leaves a message, which will be later found by investigators, stating, "Next time, it will be very precise." After February 26, 1993, there were threat assessments predicting the possibility of terrorists crashing a plane into the World Trade Center. Again, remember that they said after September 11th that nobody thought that anybody would do anything like this. See all of these examples? Who got caught with their pants down? Who was the bully on the playground? Following the 1993 World Trade Center bombing, the New York Port Authority asks investigative and security consulting firm Kroll Associates to help design new security measures for the World Trade Center. Kroll's deputy chairman, Brian Michael Jenkins, leads the analysis of future terrorist threats and how they might be addressed. Assessments conclude that a second terrorist attack against the World Trade Center is probable. Although it is considered unlikely, the possibility of terrorists deliberately flying a plane into the World Trade Center is included in the range of possible threats. After February 26th, a security chief predicts terrorists flying a plane into the World Trade Center. Rick Rescorla, a Vietnam veteran who had also previously worked for British intelligence, is vice president for security at Morgan Stanley Dean Witter and has an office in the South World Trade Center Tower. Following the 1993 bombing, he believes terrorists will attack the World Trade Center again, this time by flying a cargo plane, maybe loaded with biological or chemical weapons into it. Fred McBee, a close friend of his, will later say he assumed it would be the terrorists' mission to bring down the World Trade Center. Rescorla therefore wants his company to leave the World Trade Center and relocate to New Jersey, but their lease doesn't expire until 2006. Previously, he had predicted an attack much like the 1993 bombing. Around 1990, along with a friend and ex-Special Forces soldier Dan Hill, he had done a security survey of the World Trade Center and concluded that the biggest threat to it was an underground truck bomb. He had met with the New York Port Authority security officials about this, but according to Hill, it was told that it was none of his business. Rescorla will be in his office on the 44th floor of the South Tower at the time of the first attack on 9/11 and immediately order and supervise a successful evacuation of almost all of Morgan Stanley's 2,700 workers from the building. Unfortunately, he will himself die in the tower collapse. Spring 93, blind shake plot to crash airplane into U.S. embassy in Egypt. These just keep coming, these attempts to blow in planes. Spring 93, U.S. intelligence connects Ramzi Youssef and bin Laden. U.S. intelligence learns of ties between Ramzi Youssef and bin Laden. FBI official Neil Herman, head of the World Trade Center bombing investigation, will later say the first connection with bin Laden came in connection with some phone records overseas connecting either Youssef or possibly one of his family members. But Herman adds that bin Laden was just one of thousands of leads we were trying to run out. Bin Laden will later praise Youssef, but say, unfortunately, I did not know him before the incident. March 93 to 96, FBI uninterested in warnings of California terrorist cell. In 92 and 93, the blind sheikh, Sheikh Omar Abdul Rahman, visits a mosque in Anaheim and is hosted by an Al-Qaeda sleeper cell in Anaheim at Disneyland. Cell leaders Hisham Dayab and Khalil Deek live next door to each other and are avid followers of Abdul Rahman. Apparently, he stays with Deek on one trip and with Diab on another. Sarah Olson, Diab's wife, sees Abdul Rahman on television in connection with the February bombing and fears that her husband is a terrorist. She will later claim, I called the FBI. I said I have information about the blind sheikh. He's been to my house and I need to speak to someone. But she will say, they responded, we don't know who you're talking about. Thank you for the information. And they hung up. From 90 until 96, when she divorces Diab, she claims that some of Osama bin Laden's top deputies would stay with her and her husband. She claims she repeatedly tried to warn the FBI about this, but was never taken seriously. She also claims that even after Abdul Rahman was arrested in mid-93, he would regularly call Diab from prison each Sunday and deliver fiery sermons that were recorded and distributed to some of his other followers. U.S. intelligence had been investigating Deek since at least the late 80s, but never took any action against him. Apparently, also in the early 90s, Deek attracts attention for his suspected involvement with a militant group led by Abdul Rahman because of the group's plans to bomb a Masonic temple in Los Angeles. Diab eventually becomes a U.S. citizen and then will leave the U.S. in June 2001. He's now believed to be hiding in Pakistan with top al-Qaeda leaders. The FBI has been asked about Olson's allegations, but has neither confirmed nor denied them. April 93, Saeed Sheikh travels to Bosnia and joins a militant group there. Shortly after May 93, Ali Mohammed describes an al-Qaeda training camps, possibly more, to U.S. military. Double agent Ali Mohammed is interviewed by the U.S. military about al-Qaeda, but what exactly is said is uncertain because the interview files are supposedly lost. When Mohammed's FBI handler, John Zent, interviewed him in May 93, he mentioned al-Qaeda training camps. FBI agent Jack Clunan, who will later investigate Mohammed, will recall John realizes that Ali is talking about all these training camps in Afghanistan and starts talking about this guy named bin Laden. So John calls the local rep from Army Intelligence and arranges for them to interview him. A special team of Army investigators shows up from Fort Meade, Virginia, which is the home of the NSA. They bring maps with them and they bring evidence, and so they debrief Ali. And he stays, and he lays out all these training camps. What else he may have revealed is not known. Clunan is not sure why Mohammed volunteered all this vital al-Qaeda information. Earlier in the year, FBI investigators discovered that Mohammed stole many top-secret U.S. military documents and gave them to Islamic militants. However, Mohammed faces no trouble from the Defense Department about that. FBI agent Joseph O'Brien will later ask who in the government was running the show. Why didn't the Bureau bring the hammer down on this guy, Mohammed, then and there? Whatever Mohammed says in this interview is not shared with U.S. intelligence agency, even though it would have obvious relevance for the worldwide manhunt for Ramzi Youssef going on at the time, since Youssef trained in some of the camps Mohammed is describing. Several years later, Clunan will attempt to find the report of Mohammed's interview with Army Intelligence, but we were never able to find it. We were told that the report was probably destroyed in a reorganization of intelligence components in the defense departments. June 24, 93, New York Landmarks bombing plot is foiled. Eight people are arrested foiling a plot to bomb several New York City landmarks. The targets were the United Nations building, 26 Federal Plaza, and the Lincoln and Holland tunnels. This is known as the Landmarks or Day of Terror plot. The plotters are connected to Ramzi Youssef and Sheikh Omar Abdul Rahman. If the bombing planned for later in the year had been successful, thousands would have died. An FBI informant named Imad Salem infiltrates the group, gathering information that leads to the arrests. September 93, President Clinton appoints Louis Freeh to be the new director of the FBI. He was once an FBI field agent. He will forge alliances with Republicans in Congress. This will drive a wedge between the FBI and Clinton's White House and National Security staff. He will retire in the summer of 2001. The New York Times will later claim that he left the FBI badly damaged. Lawmakers in both parties clamored for a change in the agency they attacked as ineptly managed, resistant to change, and unwilling to make mistakes. Sounds like some administrations we know today. October 93 to November 2001, Florida cell supports global jihad and is monitored by the FBI. So a Florida cell of Islamic radicals carries out fundraising, training, and recruit in Florida. In Florida, the group is monitored by the FBI, but no action is taken against it until after September 11th. The cell's most prominent members include associates of Blind Sheikh Omar Abdul Rahman, and the FBI monitors telephone conversations between them and Abdul Rahman. From January 93 to 95, after he is taken into custody in 93, Abdul Rahman, Jayusi, one of the people, calls Abdul Rahman in jail to update the Sheikh with jihad news, many times reading accounts and statements issued directly by terrorist organization. Funds are provided through bank accounts of Al-Gama Al-Islamiyya, the Islamic group, the Canadian Islamic Association, and Benevolence International, for which Hassoun files incorporation papers in Florida. The cell pays out thousands of dollars in checks, some of which are marked Chechnya, Kosovo, or for tourism. They try to talk in code, but the code is unsophisticated. For example, tourism apparently means terrorism. In addition, they are not very careful, and in one conversation overheard by the FBI, which records tens of thousands of their conversations, one plotter asks another if he has enough soccer equipment to launch an attack on the enemy. In another, the conspirators discuss a $3,500 purchase of zucchini in Lebanon. Cell members are involved in jihad through funding or direct participation in Egypt, Somalia, Bosnia, Chechnya, Afghanistan, Lebanon, Libya, Kosovo, the former Soviet Republic of Georgia, and Azerbaijan. They are involved with both bin Laden and Chechen leader Ibn Khattab. For example, in one conversation, Yusuf tells Hassoun that he will be traveling there at Osama's and Khattab's company. They publish the Islam Report, a radical magazine about jihad. It is unclear why the FBI monitors the cell for almost a decade before they do anything about it. However, some of their activities are focused on Bosnia, where the U.S. is turning a blind eye or even actively assisting Islamic militants fighting on the Bosnian side. The cell is broken up in the months after 9/11, and Hassoun, Jayusi, and Padilla are sent for trial, which begins in 2001 or 2007. October 3 and 4, 1993, Al-Qaeda and Pakistani leaders support Somalia attack on U.S. soldiers. A U.N. vehicle, 18 U.S. soldiers are attacked and killed in Mogadishu, Somalia, in a spontaneous gun battle following an unsuccessful attempt by U.S. Army Rangers to snatch a local warlord. This is the movie Black Hawk Down. A 1998 U.S. indictment will charge bin Laden and his followers with training the attackers. Now this whole long series of names of more of these people. Why is this mic doing this problem? In a March 1997 interview, bin Laden will say of the Somalia attack, "With Allah's grace, Muslims over there cooperated with some Arab mujahideen who were in Afghanistan against the American occupation troops and killed large numbers of them." November 93, Enron power plant creates demand for an Afghanistan pipeline. The Indian government approves construction of Enron's Dabhol power plant located near Bombay on the west coast of India. Enron has invested $3 billion, the largest single foreign investment in India's history. Enron owns 65% of the Dabhol liquefied natural gas power plant, intended to provide one-fifth of India's energy needs by 97. It is the largest gas-fired power plant in the world. Earlier in the year, the World Bank concluded that the plant was not economically viable and refused to invest in it. 1994, FBI watches suicide bomber train in Arizona and fails to take action. By 90, Arizona had become one of the main centers in the U.S. for radical Muslims. And it remained so through 9/11. For instance, a terrorism expert will later call the principal mosque in Tucson the focal point of basically the first cell of Al-Qaeda in the United States. That's where it all started. A number of future Al-Qaeda leaders live in Arizona in the early 90s. The founder of the mosque is later considered one of the founders of Al-Qaeda and its logistics chief. Around 1991, future 9/11 hijacker Hani Hanjour moved to Arizona for the first time, and he will spend much of the rest of the decade in the state. The FBI apparently remains largely oblivious of Hanjour, though one FBI informant claims that by 1998 they knew everything about the guy. In 94, the Phoenix FBI office uncovers startling evidence connecting Arizona to radical Muslim militants. According to FBI agent James Hosworth, they are told that a group of heavy-duty associates of Al-Qaeda leader Sheikh Omar Abdul Rahman have arrived in the area, fleeing New York in the wake of the 93 World Trade Center bombing. They are in the area to train a recruit as a suicide bomber. The recruit apparently is an FBI informant. FBI agent Ken Williams, who will later author the July 2001 Phoenix memo, orders the surveillance of the training. The informant is driven to a remote stretch of desert and instructed on how to use explosives. A device is thrown at a car, but it fails to explode. The FBI secretly videotapes the entire incident. One of the two men is later positively linked to Abdul Rahman, but apparently the investigation into the people involved fails to make progress. Hosworth later blames this on a lack of support from higher-ups in the Phoenix office, recalling the drug war was the big thing back then, and terrorism was way on the back burner. Additionally, also in 94, a key FBI informant will begin monitoring local radical militants. However, terrorism will remain a low priority for the Phoenix, Arizona FBI office.